Well, put your science hat on. We're going to be talking with Gordon Dillo more about fire in the sky, asteroids, and we're going to talk about comets, too, when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Gordon Dillo with us as we talk about fire in the sky. Gordon, we haven't talked about comets yet, but that's a possibility, too, isn't it?
Yeah, it's less of a possibility. There just aren't as many. There's a billion comets out there in the Kuiper Belt and the Oort Cloud, but that's way, way out at the edge of the solar system. And the ones that pass close to Earth, there's just not that many of them. I mean, the comets have been, people have been searching for comets since the invention of the telescope and 400 years, and they've only discovered about 5,000 of them so far. So in terms of impacts with Earth, comets aren't considered as much of a threat, although if one came in, they're traveling so fast, they run at about 120,000 miles an hour or something. Jeez. Like that. Yeah, the impact would be even worse than an asteroid.
The most spectacular was the collision with Jupiter by comet Shoemaker-Levy.
Yes.
Years ago. That was dramatic to see as it just kept bombarding it. How dangerous is the tail, Gordon, of a comet? Well, can that do anything?
The tail, pretty much, it's vapor for the most part. Small, very, very small particles, and they can stretch out over 100 million miles of space. But they give us meteors. As we pass through the tail of a comet that's come pretty close to Earth, these little tiny particles collide with the atmosphere and give us those meteors that flash across the sky.
What is the difference between a meteor and an asteroid?
Well, a meteor is actually just the flash of light. It's not the physical particle of space rock.
Okay.
That causes it. It's just the flash of light that it produces when it travels through the atmosphere at such a high speed.
Interesting take. So, as of right now, you said that the one asteroid is Apophis. That could be a problem.
Well, again, the scientists are pretty sure, and they feed these into supercomputers at the Jet Propulsion Lab and factor in all these different factors as to, the gravitational influences on them and that sort of stuff. And they've been pretty good at predicting, the ones that are going to miss. And Apophis, they assure us, is going to miss by about 19,000 miles, which, again,
that's close.
Really, really close.
Yes, it is. It's about 19,000 miles too close, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, it's sort of like, proportionally, it's sort of like a bullet missing your head by 16 inches. It doesn't hurt you and it doesn't kill you, but if you got any brains at all, it should draw your attention.
Let's go to the phones. Wildcard line. We've got Doc in Petaluma, California. Hey, Doc, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Gordon, do you think maybe that we have tectonic plates because of that early impact with that planet-sized object? And we see the Earth would cool at the same time and it would be a nice solid crust. And then when that planet hit us and we absorbed that planet into us, and I guess it created the moon, they say. Wouldn't that have made the tectonic plates of the broken up crust, and that's why the surface of the Earth is floating?
It could have. That's an interesting thought, because an impact that size would shroud the Earth in super temperatures.
Oh my gosh!
So I'm not a geologist, so I don't know if that would actually cause the plates. It could have shattered somehow. The crust in a way. That's an interesting idea, Doc.
And by the way, you dedicated your book to your parents, that you're all right in my book for that, Gordon.
Oh, well, I miss them. I wish they were still here.
Yeah, I know that feeling. My mom's still alive. She just turned 90 last week.
Oh, good for her. God bless her.
I lost my dad a few years ago.
Sorry to hear that.
What would be, in your opinion, your biggest concern based on the work you did to write the book Fire in the Sky? What would you be more concerned about right now?
Well, again, I think it would be the UFOs, the asteroids that we don't know about.
I knew this was a book about Travis Walton. See?
Well, the UFOs I'm talking about, and there's millions of them in the book, but these unidentified flying objects are space rocks. They're not, visits from aliens and that sort of thing. With all due respect to the UFO community, I mean, that's certainly something to talk about.
Sure.
But it's kind of beyond my scope.
But these asteroids that keep coming, and they keep coming, I mean, will this be one of those things where we wake up one morning and a city is gone? Could it happen that quickly?
That might be unusual, because especially as we get better on the technology of detecting these asteroids, right now they have one space-based satellite that's involved in asteroid detection. They're talking about sending up another one called NEOCAM that would be much more effective in spotting these things. And if it was big enough to take out a city, I think we might get some warning on that. It might not be much warning, but FEMA and other government agencies, they actually take this seriously. They have contingency plans for evacuations and that sort of stuff in case something like this happens.
Well, they will know, though, if they spot the asteroid, they'll, one, know the size, and they will probably be able to predict mathematically where it's going to hit, right?
They generally can. If they get enough observations and they have enough time, they can pinpoint it. We talked earlier about the war game, the asteroid war game that they played at the recent Planetary Defense Conference. And that's absolutely scientifically true. They can determine a zone, it's kind of a line across the Earth where the asteroid is going to hit. And then as it becomes closer, they can pinpoint within the zone exactly where it's going to hit.
And, you know, horribly speaking, of course, all of us would say, gosh, I hope it doesn't hit where we are, you know, but you know what? It could hit any place, couldn't it?
It could hit any place, and it's not just the impact that would be the problem. FEMA studies these things, and imagine if, and, you know, they insist they would not keep this secret, that they would have to, you know, let this out. Imagine the impact on property values.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, if you said, well, an asteroid is going to hit downtown Houston, who's going to buy a house in Houston?
There will be no houses in Houston.
That's right. So, the impact goes kind of beyond the physical destruction, into a host of economic issues and political issues and all sorts of things.
Let's go to Paul in Boston, Mass. Hey, Paul, go ahead.
John, you keep getting me all scared again. I don't want to go to sleep.
You'll never get to bed with this show, Paul.
I have a question. If you were able to nudge one of these or slow it down, you change the apogee. What about the perigee, the return flight?
What up there? You're breaking up a little bit, Paul, but we will talk to Gordon about that. So if you change, go ahead, Gordon. I think you heard a little bit from him, didn't you?
Yeah, I heard a little bit, but I didn't quite get it. If we change the orbit of the asteroid, what's going to happen?
He was talking about apogee and perigee. But I don't think that has anything to do with it. Once you change the course, that's it, right?
Yeah. Well, once you change the course, it's going to continue on its new orbit. Basically, you're just changing the orbit that it's in by just the tiniest bit, little bit.
Just a nudge.
Or you slow it down a little bit.
See, my biggest concern, though, has always been breaking it up as it comes, this discussion about setting out nukes, blowing it up. So you blow up, let's say you blow up a half a mile size asteroid. If you blow it up, haven't you created thousands of 200-foot asteroids?
Yes, but if you blow it up while it's still, say, 10 million miles from Earth, it's like shotgun pellets. When you shoot a shotgun, the pellets are very close together as they leave the muzzle of the shotgun.
Then they spread out.
The further they go, the more they spread out. So then the chances of any one of those pellets hitting the Earth becomes that much less. If you exploded it while it was close to the Earth, if the pieces were small enough, if you could get it, blow it into less than...
And there's no guarantee you could do that.
No, and that's... That's one of the problems. I mean, they work these out theoretically, on computers, and, if we do A, then B will happen. But it hasn't really been tested. In fact, the first anti-asteroid asteroid mitigation mission that NASA is called DART, and it's a mission to go to a binary asteroid. It's called the Double Asteroid Redirection Test, DART, and they're sending up an unmanned spacecraft to do one of these kinetic impactors to ram into a small but non-threatening asteroid, just to see what effect will it have if we hit it with this much weight and this much speed. How much will it slow it down? So we're in kind of a window here where we really aren't prepared at this point physically for an asteroid impact. But within the next few decades, we very well could be.
Let's go to John in Virginia Beach, Virginia, east of the Rockies. Welcome to the show, John.
Yeah, George, a belated happy birthday.
Thank you, sir.
And when are you going to sing a song on the radio for us?
I want to keep my audience, John.
Gordon, I have a question. You may have already answered it, but I'll ask it anyway.
Sure.
The asteroid is heading toward Earth. How much time will we have warning?
Well, that's going to depend. Sometimes, as we were talking about earlier, sometimes we don't detect asteroids that come close to Earth until they've already passed us by. Sometimes, on a few occasions, we've been able to. And when I say we, I'm talking about the astronomers that are on mountaintops around the world. On some occasions, they've been able to spot them in advance. So it's kind of hit and miss at this point. A lot of it depends on how big it is. Small asteroids are very hard to detect, even with the most powerful telescopes, because they're small and they don't reflect much sunlight. Bigger ones are easier to spot. So that's really kind of up in the air. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but it really would vary. We could have 30 years of advance warning, could have a couple of days.
That's right. Or no days.
Or no days.
How many people, Gordon, are working on the near-Earth asteroid program?
Well, the joke used to be that there were more people working a daylight shift at a McDonald's than there were who were involved in,
I believe
in asteroid
that.
Detection. That was back 20, 30 years ago. Now, there's several thousand, including amateurs. Amateur astronomers with, pretty sophisticated telescopes in their backyards, they help on follow-up observations. In other words, if one of the NASA astronomers spots an asteroid and, tries to, determine its orbit, the amateurs will hone in on it and give further observations so that they can refine the orbit and they can really figure out, okay, this thing is going to be here on this date and that sort of thing.
Let's go to Dan, truck driving in Illinois. Hi, Dan. Go ahead.
Hey, George. Belated happy birthday.
Thank you.
And if one of these things ever hits Illinois, they'll just figure out how to raise our taxes.
Yeah, they would.
Well, there would be a tax problem because they estimate in some of these asteroid war games, they estimate the economic damage, not only the physical damage, but the loss of jobs, the everything, and it could be in the trillions.
Even though the killer size, the 6-mile asteroid would be a disaster, no matter where it hits, correct?
Sure.
Yeah. You've heard of the caldera in Yellowstone, which is that inverted volcano, basically.
Yeah, the caldera, the Yellowstone caldera.
If that thing goes, we've got even a bigger problem.
Well, it could be bigger than an asteroid. It would depend on how big the asteroid is. But, yeah, Yellowstone is bubbling. Now, they say it's probably not going to happen anytime soon. But when it did happen, 700,000 years ago, when it did erupt, that was a game changer.
If we have enough time to hit an asteroid, what exactly would the plan be if it were coming this way? Would it be determined on distance and size? What are the complexities that make up the rationale for what we're going to do and how we're going to handle it?
Well, it's a function of distance, how how soon we can do it. And we have to remember that if we did spot an asteroid, we currently don't have, you know, built and standing by, rocket and space vehicle systems that are capable of doing it. You know, at this point, they're all theoretical. It's not like ICBMs. ICBMs aren't designed to take on an asteroid in space. So it would take years to put together, you know, a program and a mission to try to stop this thing. So again, you know, early detection, it's sort of like cancer. Early detection is the key.
Sure is. Next up, let's go to Mimi in Midland, Texas. Hi, Mimi. Go ahead.
Hi, George. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks.
I have a question, but I also have a little event that took place in my life. When I was 6, I was asleep. I suddenly waked up, went into the living room where my parents were watching TV. Of course, they wondered what I was doing out of bed, but I went straight to the window. The whole night sky lit up brighter than daylight.
You had a meteorite of biblical proportions out there.
Well, it was green.
Yep, that's what they are.
And it fell, fortunately, into White Rock Lake, which was right in front of H.L. Hunt's house. And I've never forgotten it, the green glow and how it looked. But maybe that's my question.
Well, I was just going to say that's a lot of people never see these things in their whole life, so you should consider yourself fortunate.
I do, and it impacted me, you know, psychologically the rest of my life. But I was wondering if you had ever heard of the Tunguska.
Oh, he sure has. He sure has.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And that, yeah, that was 1908, that was, something like that?
Yeah, it was June 30th, 1908, and in fact, this month is Asteroid Day, International Asteroid Day. It's a UN-sanctioned sort of...
Asteroid? Really? Is it like an awareness day?
It's an awareness day, and it's set on the anniversary of the Tunguska event, as they call it, in 1908. And interestingly, one of the founders of Asteroid Day is a fellow, he's an astrophysicist in England named Dr. Brian May. You may have heard of him. He's also the lead guitarist.
Oh, from Queen. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He is one heck of a guitarist, and also he's great at what he does.
Well, he gave us We Will Rock You, and he's trying to save the world from asteroids.
I love it. Now, the Tunguska, it did not hit. It was a concussion asteroid, just like the other one that hit in Russia in 2013, wasn't it?
Exactly. It was an airburst. And it was probably, it's a little hard to tell. They say it was maybe 200 feet to 600 feet wide.
Took out the forests.
Took out 100 square miles of forest. Fortunately, there was hardly anybody there but some reindeer. But it was the biggest impact that we had in, not so much in memory, but in recording.
In modern history, indeed. We're going to come back, Gordon, and take final phone calls with you. Gordon Dillo with us, Fire in the Sky. Gordon, do you think that if a asteroid was headed this way, that the planet would band together regardless of where it was going to hit?
That's always the question because, again, they're able to determine a kind of a zone of uncertainty that crosses the Earth, and it would cover some countries, and it would not cover other countries. So the question is, does everybody chip in to pay for these very expensive asteroid mitigation space missions? That's what they're trying to work out. And it's you wonder how humanity would react in the face of something like this.
I mean, because could they say, well, it's going to hit China, oh, well, or something like that. And I think we should band together as a world force and do something to help each other.
Well, they do have some international organizations like the International Asteroid Warning Network, and which is UN-sanctioned, and some other ones that are supposed to do that. But as you know, George, once politics gets involved, I mean, there's going to be some people who say, okay, that's China's problem.
That's right.
You know, Others might say, oh, we need to, you know, all stick together on this thing. I don't know. In some ways, I'm a pessimist as I look back over history as to whether how much stick togetherness there's going to be out there in the face of a threat like this. I would hope so.
Let's go to Walton, Pennsylvania. Walter, go ahead.
Happy birthday, George.
Thank you, Walter.
And now I can say that I can once again say that I'm a little younger than you are. I turned 68 in February.
Walter, we don't announce ages here on the program.
Georgia, Gordon is a terrific guest. He's in a class with Dr. Alan Stern. Dr. Alan Stern, George, is your only guest that makes me feel stupid.
You said it.
Walt, happy birthday to you, too, and I've got you by about a month, so I'm younger than you are.
Oh, thank you. Well, regarding the, you know, the famous impact, the Chichen Itza impact of 65 million years ago that, quote-unquote, wiped out the dinosaurs, from what I understand, a lot of paleozoologists think that that isn't entirely true. They think that some of the dinosaurs survived and that birds are their ancestors. In other words, a lot of zoologists think that birds are actually dinosaurs, because if you look at, you know, the skeleton of a chicken, it's essentially identical to a T-Rex skeleton.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at birds, like especially birds that, you know, are more terrestrial as opposed to being able to fly, like the ostrich and the emu, an ostrich actually looks very similar to a duck-billed dinosaur.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're right on the money with that, Walt. And in the book, I'm careful to say, I kind of made a shorthand when I'm talking, but when I say it wiped out the dinosaurs, in the book I point out it wiped out most of the dinosaurs, because the feeling now is that you're absolutely right. There's certain avian kind of dinosaurs that survived.
Yep, indeed. Well, you know, when you look at a bird, if it didn't have feathers, they'd look like little pterodactyls, wouldn't they?
Well, some people think that some of the dinosaurs had feathers as well. So it's just tough to know what happened 65 million years ago with a lot of specificity.
Wayne is truck driving in Indiana. Wayno, go ahead.
Morning, everybody.
Hello, sir.
Hey, would it be possible for one, I suppose, of a large enough size that it could knock the Earth out of its orbit, change its orbit, or, you know, even tilt it more or less on its axis?
Yeah, we were talking about this earlier, and that would be possible, although for an asteroid that big to hit, we wouldn't care if it was knocked off its axis, because it would wipe out everything down to the molecular level on Earth. That's not considered very likely, but theoretically it's certainly possible if it got hit big enough. They think that the reason it's tilted on its axis now is because Earth billions of years ago got hit by an extremely large protoplanet that knocked off enough of the Earth's surface to form the moon, tilted it on its axis, and just raised all kind of problems.
Gordon Dillo with us. His book is called Fire in the Sky. It's about the possibility of an asteroid strike, of course. Gordon, when we look at the possibilities that's out there, do you think an amateur astronomer might be the one to detect these things before some pro at NASA?
It's possible. Amateurs, you know, do discover asteroids all the time. The thing is, their telescopes, while pretty sophisticated, I've talked to some amateurs that, you know, have telescopes in their backyards with, you know, like observatories and that sort of stuff. They run into the tens of thousands of dollars. More likely it would be spotted by a professional and then confirmed through observations by amateurs. But it's certainly possible. So, you know, if you're out there and you have a telescope, watch the skies.
Let's go to Robert in California on the wildcard line. Hey, Robert, go ahead.
Hey, George, your birthday was yesterday. Mine is today.
Well, happy birthday
happy
to you,
birthday
Robert.
To us.
Absolutely.
Back in 1980, I was attending Humboldt State University, And while going from Arcata to McKinleyville up US 101 one Sunday evening, I saw coming in across the Pacific Ocean a rock. And it was coming in pretty flat trajectory. And as it passed overhead, it was roughly cuboidal in shape. And I couldn't tell how high it was. I estimated the top of the Cascades was about 1,000 to 1,500 feet above the roadbed, and it cleared that by I don't know how much. So it was considerably, had some considerable altitude.
How big was it?
Nearest minimum size was at least 20 feet on a side. I think it was probably close to the size of a small house.
Wow.
It had three small jets coming out from three different sides. Kind of looked like a torch on idle.
Was it flying in like fast?
No, not that fast. It was
really?
Coming in. It looks sort of like a car going about 40, 45 miles an hour.
Well, that's kind of slow, I guess.
No, just kind of cruising along, dead quiet.
Are you sure it was a rock?
Where it hit, but it must have hit somewhere, probably on the foothills of the Sierra Nevada.
Gordon, would it be that slow coming in?
Well, not an asteroid, because asteroids coming in generally are about 30,000, 40,000 miles an hour. And if it was an asteroid, it would be ablating. In other words, it would be the front of it, you know, caused by friction in the atmosphere, would be blazing. You know, sort of like when a space capsule reenters the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they always show the diagrams with flames coming off it. And the same thing happens to asteroids. So, Robert, I don't know exactly what it was, but from what it sounds like, it doesn't sound like it was an asteroid.
Maybe a craft of some sort. Robert, what do you think?
And like I say, it was coming in at a real flat trajectory.
Hmm.
It was probably maybe coming down at an angle of about 10 degrees, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So apparently it came in at just the right angle like the capsules do. And
Well, you know, there are asteroids that they call them Earth grazers, that will pass through the upper level of the atmosphere and then just zip right back out into space. They don't blow up or, you know.
They skip almost like a rock
like
in
that.
A pond or something.
Exactly, huh? Exactly.
Interesting. Mark in Monterey, California is with us. Hey, Mark, go ahead.
Hey, this is a great opportunity to let your audience hear about something I saw when I was about 12 years old in Healdsburg, California. I called Art Bell about this decades ago.
Ah, okay.
It was a meteorite asteroid the size of a huge mountain. I'm not exaggerating. I mean, huge, 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 huge. Only 3,000 miles away. It took up a sixth of the sky. It lit up the whole landscape like a flashbulb for a split second. If you'd have blinked, you'd have missed it. It was mysteriously, absolutely silent. It went from Healdsburg, Northern California, to Hawaii in less than 2 seconds. And I'm talking, this thing's bigger than Mount Shasta.
What happened to it?
Well, it just was coming at such a flat trajectory, it just missed us by, like I said, about 3,000 miles. Now, you look at the Yucatan Peninsula crater, I believe the entire Gulf of Mexico is caused by that impact. And the state of Florida is the seabed that was pushed up
mm-hmm.
to make a sandbar.
Could be.
That's how big the rock I saw was.
Jeez.
Now, the other thing I want to let people know is I'm the famous activist, Stephen Mark Lightfoot, who actually discovered the evidence that proves Nixon and Reagan.
Got to let him go. Gordon?
I'm sorry?
You could not have an asteroid that big.
Well, theoretically, yeah. But I think we would have heard about it if it had come anywhere close, because an asteroid that big, if it was coming in towards Earth, would have impacted. If they're big enough, they can make it through the atmosphere without burning up.
Let's go to Joe in Long Island, New York. Joseph, go ahead.
Two quick questions and a comment on the dinosaurs. First, could a satellite, Gordon, be hit, like, say, one satellite, and it would affect adjacent satellites like a cascade effect by a small meteor or asteroid? And then what was the collective consciousness on asteroids, say, pre-discovery of the telescope and after discovery, Copernicus, you know, did that change the awareness of the possibilities? And also on the dinosaurs, I don't believe the timeline. I don't believe that the reconstructed dinosaurs you see in the Museum of Natural History in New York was from 65 million years ago. I don't think bones would survive any near that time frame. It would have to be much, much closer to the present.
Yeah. Well, in terms of the satellites, we talked earlier about asteroid Apophis coming within 19,000 miles of Earth in 2029. There is some concern, and again, space is a pretty big place, but there is some concern that it could collide with one of our telecommunication satellites or something like that. So, you know, people are talking about that, and hopefully they got some time to work that out. In terms of the dinosaur bones, the bones you see in the museums, most of those aren't really bones. I mean, they've been reconstructed. They only have, you know, a very small percentage. But the bones they have are fossilized, basically turned to rocks. So it is possible that that they could have lasted that long.
It's just amazing the possibilities that all this brings to us, doesn't it?
It does. It's amazing.
Fire in the Sky, where do people get the book?
Well, you know, the best way, it's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. The best way is to search Fire in the Sky and my last name, Dillow, D-I-L-L-O-W. That'll take you right to it, and it'll tell you where you can find the best deal.
Time for a few more calls, I believe. Let's go to M, truck driving in Oregon, first-time caller. M, welcome to the program.
Hi. I have actually a specific question. Sometime this fall, I believe it was October or November 2018, going northbound past Pahrump, and there's the infamous alien truck stop going northbound, and it was towards the evening. It wasn't quite dark. There was this brilliant and beautiful kind of a slanted kind of S-shaped, S as in Sam, shaped meteor, and I was telling my husband, that is a meteor. What the heck? Mm. It was amazing. And then from there, we went into, we stopped and got some fuel as per usual at that alien truck stop in some, and it was on a Wednesday. And some, at least I remember it was Wednesday. And a guy said, oh, weird stuff happens out here on Wednesdays all the time. And I kind of thought, well, that's fine. I did try to call your show to kind of find out if there was a heads up from anyone.
I bet Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center probably had a lot of calls that day.
Well, I know that the KGO and other California shows were saying, oh, yeah, this is what we're reporting. It was so close to San Francisco. But it was, to my vision, it was actually closer northbound and pretty straightforward from, you know, in that valley.
And you don't think it was a rocket launch, do you?
No, and it was kind of funny because that guy who said, because there's a lot of activity that is not really actually reported as far as, like, there's that nuclear site.
Yep.
That they, yeah, okay, great. Anyway, yep. So there's things that go on there. They don't really talk about, don't advertise, but they're there. If you look, you can see it. Well, that night, there was a lot of discussion on different programs, and I think briefly on your program,
mm-hmm.
but then everyone dropped it, and we never could really find out, and it was kind of this, it was nice to view it and go, wow, we're seeing something.
It was one of those wow factors, and because, you know, once you see it and nobody else reports on it, and the governments deny what it is because they don't know, it's gone. It disappears. So what do you recommend, Gordon, that people do if they witness things strange in the sky? And I'm not talking about UFOs.
Yeah. Well, there's a the American, I think it's the American Meteorite Society, has a fireball page where they encourage people who see things like this to call in and, you know, just report what they see. And, they take it seriously. They don't dismiss people. In terms of what M is talking about, you know, an S-shaped
Generally, meteors, fireballs, you know, they move in a pretty straight line. The S shape, I don't know. Sometimes they'll leave contrails that pick up sunlight, you know, and can be in all sorts of different shapes and stuff. I don't know if that adequately or accurately describes what M saw, but it's possible.
It is indeed. Gordon, good luck with the book. Thank you for coming on the program. Let's keep in touch. You're a great guest. Up next, deja vu, psychokinesis, near-death experiences. We've got it all.